This is an ABC podcast.
Today, Shanghai is one of the most exciting cities in the world. It's like New York or Tokyo. But it wasn't always like this. When Michel Garneau arrived in Shanghai in the mid-90s, it was still pulling itself out of decades of communist isolation and starting to recover a bit of its old pre-war glamour. Michel Garneau was an Australian restaurateur who had already set up a fabulously successful restaurant in Hong Kong in the 1980s. And in the 90s, Michel was lured to a dynamic new Shanghai that was ready to open up to the world again. Michel set up a restaurant on Shanghai's legendary Bund, that grand old boulevard that runs next to the Huangpo River, which has become one of the most famous restaurants in the world now. Amazingly, Michel failed cookery at high school in Melbourne. So even though she couldn't quite crack it at rock cakes and lamb's fry, she ended up conquering Shanghai without an army. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Richard.
You grew up in Melbourne. Tell me about the circumstances of your early life, how you moved around a fair bit.
Yes, actually, I did. I had various, let's say, incarnations of life in Melbourne, and I lived in different socioeconomic areas. And that, I think, is quite interesting. And so I was born in South Yarra. It was all a bit fancy.
Posh. Mm.
Then we moved to, my grandparents always lived in East Malvern, Malvern East, as it's called now, apparently. They always lived there. So that was a constant thing through my life. But then we moved to Broadmeadows. We moved to Jacana.
Well, hang on. Whoa. Well, yeah. That's a big leap from
South
leap. Yarra to
that
Broadie.
Was it. Yeah, South Yarra to Broadie.
Yeah.
And I have a brother who will absolutely keel over when he hears me even saying this. And then we moved to Blackburn.
Right, outer eastern suburbs of Melbourne.
Outer eastern suburbs of Melbourne. And actually the streets weren't paved when we moved there. So in 1960, it must have been about 64 or something like that, 65 maybe, we moved there.
I had a very early childhood in Doncaster and it was a similar thing right next
door.
Yeah,
that was exactly Doncaster. Doncaster was the big smoke down there, right, actually.
So why were you moving around so much?
I think my father had quite a sort of an itinerant life. He was an complicated person, but things changed. I'm the oldest of nine children, and I guess we probably needed bigger houses. I guess that's one reason.
Was the family's income going up and down at that period? Or was it just the nine kids? That'll do it, I suppose.
I guess it was the nine kids.
Were your parents a good match?
I think there'd be a lot of people who'd say no, but I'm sure that I wouldn't be here if they weren't, would I? So, yeah.
So where did you fit in as the eldest of nine, Michelle? What was your role?
The bossy one.
The bossy one?
Yeah, and the oldest sister. I have three brothers after me, then two sisters and a brother and two sisters. So, yeah, I'm the bossy one. I got to boss everybody around, and I got to deal a lot with a lot of, having to do a lot of mothering.
Right. Yeah. Was that enough mothering for you?
Yeah, I think so. I once heard my mother say, she did all her mothering when she was a teenager. And I said, oh, really? I thought that's interesting.
That's a fair bit of administration, I suppose, isn't it, being the oldest of nine kids that you've got to sort of mother and look
after? I guess there is a fair bit of administration. My father was a bit of a wild card. My mother was pretty organized. And we had for a while, we had our aunt. Auntie Di came and lived with us after my father died. My mother wasn't well. And she was matron of a hospital. So basically, we called her the general. She actually said the other day, oh, they called me the sergeant. And I said, no, Di, we called you the general. She sort of got order. I remember lists everywhere and sort of like jobs. And I mean, we were terrified of her, absolutely terrified of her. But anyway, she's a gorgeous creature. We love her to death.
Was food important in your house?
My mother is actually really not a very good cook, and she won't be offended if I say that. She'll laugh. I guess...
Not a lot of people were back in those days.
I think not a lot of people were, although my father quite liked cooking, but he was like in a typical male way, came into the kitchen, made an enormous mess, you know, spent the year's budget, peeled the grapes, did sort of massively elaborate things, served some dinner and everybody else had to clean up.
You know, the other thing men require, we require after having done this, we want a medal at the end of that.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly what he wanted.
He talked about it for the rest of the year. Yeah. Oh, remember my soul, Veronique. It was like, of course I remember it. I had to peel a bloody grapes. But so he was a real man about town. You know, he was... really a man about town. So he would go to restaurants and it was quite glamorous and spend lots of money. And I remember he talked about avocados, you know, in the 60s. And
that was the height of exotic.
Yeah,
there,
the
wasn't
height
it?
Of exotic yeah. was an avocado and prawn cocktail, I guess, you know. So anyway, he had sort of interesting views, but he was not really around very much when we were kids. And my mother comes from good, Irish, English, Catholic stock. And my grandmother considered herself a very good cook. And my grandfather, my grandparents were married 57 years. And every day he said, oh, I'm the luckiest man in the world, which, you know, lucky her. But she cooked and she timed everything with how many cigarettes it took. So you put the casserole on. It's true. It's true. They'll all kill me for telling everybody this, but she put, first of all, I think the potatoes, of course, had to go, or the casserole. If there was a casserole, it was in the oven already. She, you know, 11 o'clock in the morning, because she had to have her solo ladies there and play cards. And then she would turn the potatoes on, have one cigarette, then turn on like the cauliflower, have another cigarette, then turn on the peas, have another cigarette, maybe the carrots or something. Then turn on, that was all boiling away with the lids on, you know, everything boiled to death. And then she would make the white sauce, so that might have already been made for the cauliflower, and then she'd put that on. And it all got timed with the amount of cigarettes backwards.
Not a bad system, I suppose.
It was a system that worked. It was the same with the tea. You made the tea, you turned on the timer, you lit a cigarette, and when you finished the cigarette, the timer went off and you could have the tea.
So, like I said, is that really true that I said at the start, that you failed cookery at school?
It's true. What,
once, twice, more often?
I think twice. I think we did it 2 years in a row. First of all, I failed needlework because I didn't make my apron. I had to embroider your name on your apron, on your gingham apron. I remember I made gingham hot pants. Sure.
Not much of a future for M. Garneau at the age of 16. It's failed at embroidery and cooking.
No, yeah, I'd failed at embroidery. I failed at cooking. Right. But I actually got blamed. There was a really funny girl in our class called Diane Hedgekey. She was smarter than everybody else put together, apart from all the super smart Jewish kids at Elwood High School, because they were all super smart. And she was so naughty, though. She used to go, she actually once had us all sleep out. This is how naughty she was. She had us all tell our parents we were staying at different people's places. We were about 14, I think, and we all went and slept in a cemetery.
Wow. Yeah, really?
She was right. A nutcase of a girl. You know, she was totally mad. Anyway, she would walk into the into the home ec class. Somehow she figured out getting in there. She'd walk into the home ec class and she'd take a bite out of like every rock cake or every scone or every sandwich or the blancmange or something. And the teacher would come in and we would sit in those rows and she'd say, Michelle Garneau, it's how I didn't do it. And she said, well, if you didn't do it, who did it? I didn't do it.
Okay, let the word go forth on that Michelle did not do it.
I did not do it. Actually, Diane Hedgekey did. If she's listening to this,
yes.
Thanks a bunch.
Sprung.
And about your crazy bad ideas about cemeteries. I don't think we stayed there all night, actually. I think she just took us through and scared us at, you know, 7 o'clock when it was dark or something.
So this brings us to the late 70s. And how keen were you to get out of Australia?
I was in the mid-70s.
Mid-70s.
No, everybody left. Actually, I had something on the radio this morning of somebody saying, oh, yeah, but everybody hitchhiked and everybody left. It wasn't that unusual. People now say to me, you left? You didn't have a mobile telephone?
Yeah.
You didn't have like email?
Yeah, didn't have Expedia, none of that. How did you break it to your mum, given that you were such a huge figure in raising the other kids?
She reminded me of this the other day. I wasn't living at home. She was there washing the dishes. She still washes the dishes. She's never had a dishwasher. She loves washing dishes. And I went and I said to her, oh, hey, Mom, I booked a ticket for, we call her Ange, actually. I said, hey, Ange, I booked a ticket. I'm going to Greece. And she sort of didn't say a word. And I said, what are you upset about? And she was there and she had tears rolling down her face. And I said, what are you upset about? And she said, you should be happy I'm going. And she said, oh, well, my number one. And I was like, oh, get over it. You know, I was totally unsympathetic. I was a vile teenager. I was absolutely, I'll apologize on air, my poor mother. Anyway, she reminded me last night that my grandparents, who were quite grand, actually took me to the airport because my grandmother said, no, we never, ever go to the airport just before. We go and stay the night before at the travel lodge. And so they paid for me, took me out to the airport.
Is that a 1978,
thing? August 1978, they took me out to the airport.
The Tullamarine Travel Lodge.
Tullamarine Airport. We stayed at, right. I thought it was called the Hilton, but anyway, apparently it was called the Travel Lodge. And all my friends came and none of them told me that they were coming. So it was like a wild party, you know, and all these friends I worked with, everybody turned up, and then they all sort of took me to the airport. But my mother reminded me that actually she said, I didn't go. I wouldn't come. I couldn't deal with it. And I said, yeah, you didn't, did you? Yeah. So I think she was pretty. But anyway, she came and found me a year later. She came to Europe for the first time. She'd never been to Europe before. And she went on the tour. And I was stuck on a Greek island with a boyfriend who was a tragic story. But anyway, a different story. And poor thing, I couldn't get back. His father worked for Olympic Airlines. He was like, I'll get you back. You know, we'll find a flight for you. I couldn't get to London. She was sitting in London waiting for me. But I was about 5 days late. And you couldn't call anybody. You know, I mean, you had to book calls at the telephone exchange sort of thing. It was crazy. Anyway, I think I called my friends Judy and Philip and said, my mum's in some hotel in Kensington waiting for me and she doesn't know where I am. And eventually I got there and she said, oh my God, you put on so much weight.
Our mother-daughter relationships, that's marvellous. So you landed in Greece, somewhere in the Greek islands.
Well, I landed in Athens and then I went off to the Greek islands.
Yeah. Once you arrived, did you know anyone? Did you have any contacts?
I didn't know anybody.
Right.
I didn't know a soul. And I remember I was sort of over talking about this because I said I was coming and talking to you. And I remember when I got there, there was one guy I knew who'd been on the plane. He'd gone to Monash and he was a Greek boy. God knows what his name was. And I was wandering down the street in Athens thinking, what am I doing? Crying, tears running down my face, thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing here? I mean, I've got no idea what I'm doing. What am I going to do next? What was I thinking? Anyway, and the one person I knew out, you know, in the world was this guy who was on the plane. And he said, he walked past me, you know, outside the post office, Syntagma Square. I suppose not that unusual. I mean, he's the center of Athens. And he said, oh, you're all right. And I said, oh, I'm all right. And he said, look, my family are going to Crete. You know, they're going on the ferry. You know, why don't you just go on the ferry? At least you've got somebody on the ferry. So it did. And I did, and his sisters were really sweet. His mother, somebody found out that I was there, and his mother was like a Greek mother. She was hysterical. Anyway, nothing going on, but I got off. I got off in the wrong place and went. I got off in a place called Chania, like C-H-A-N. And I thought it was in Heraklion, but I wasn't. And I had I don't think it was a Lonely Planet. Maybe it's a Fodders or Europe on $1 a day or whatever it was then, $10 a day or whatever it was. And there was, it said, get off the ferry and walk there and turn left and turn right. And then that's the youth hostel. And I walked onto a military base. I was in the wrong place. And finally I figured out I was in the wrong place. I was in the wrong city altogether. Anyway, I eventually got to Heraklion.
So how did you learn to cook? Where did you start to learn how to do that?
I think I always liked cooking, actually. I quite liked cooking. And then I started waitressing when I was about 14 and, you know, part-time. And then I worked in a Jewish restaurant. They all thought I was Jewish. They were so sweet to me. They used to give me really big tips, all thinking I'm a Catholic girl, but they all thought I was Jewish. And that was in Ackland Street. I was 15 or I think I was nearly 16. Of course, I'd lied and said I was 18. The people who owned it was, and of course, I wouldn't eat anything except grilled tomato and cheese sandwiches. I wouldn't eat anything else. And the wonderful cook used to cook me these things, but there was gefilte fish, and I was all that. I'd say, God, the food they eat, so weird, you know.
That would have been Scheherazade or Blue Danube in
It wasn't.
Street.
It was called the Carmel.
Right, okay.
And it was next door to the Ferry Stork, and it was only there for a couple of years. And the couple who owned it, I think they were Israeli, they were really kind. They were so kind to me. Anyway, I only worked there for a couple of, you know, for 6 weeks or something over the summer. But then I kept working all the way through. So I worked through high school and I worked through university and I worked in pubs and I worked in restaurants. And I had about 2 years away in Europe. So I left in 78, I came back in 1980. I went to William Angelus College because I thought, I don't care what I do, but I'm going to travel. I don't care what I do. I'd do anything. So I went to be a travel agent. I went to find out about travel agency course. My God, that looked boring. But I took the handbook from William Anglis and I found that I could do this certificate of catering. By that time, I was about 23 or something. And I thought, that's what I'll do. So Auntie Di came with me. She said, I'll come with you. So we started a certificate of catering. She was working full time. And that's sort of what we did. And then, so I went off and you had to do cooking because it was like a diploma. And we had to do cooking and service and, you know, business maths and food hygiene and food science. I loved food science. So we had to do all of those subjects. And in cooking, I had two teachers and they both said, you've really got talent and you should be in the kitchen. And so they really pushed me to do it. And eventually I got a job cooking, but it took a long time to get a job cooking.
So then to London, to a school in London. What was the school
I
like
went
there?
To the Leith School of Food and Wine, which I knew about, you know, Leith's. I looked at different ones. I looked at like Cordon Bleu in Paris and there was another one called La Varenne. And there was also the CIA. I'd been in America. I'd spent about 8 months there. So there was the CIA, which is the Culinary Institute of America, not the CIA. And I looked at all of them and then I thought, well, London, I know London and I've got friends. I didn't have any money. So I've got friends in London. And so I went and enrolled in the last three. It was a 1 year course, but I did the third semester, which was sort of advanced cookery because I didn't need to do, you know, so I thought I'm not done eating. They're the first stuff.
So then you got to, then you started preparing food for the Orient Express.
Well, then I got offered a job in the catering company. So they also had a catering company. I was in a very dark, very dim catering company in the Angel in North London. And the most glamorous thing I ever got to do was to go to Victoria Station with food and look at all those super fancy people getting on the train and spot the famous ones, Rod Stewart, Mick Jagger, we saw one day. I was so excited.
You handed him his lunch. How nice.
No, I handed it to the white hand gloved waiters. And because I'd done quite a lot of large scale cooking, so I'd worked at then called the Wentworth Hotel when it opened. And I worked in banquets with this fantastic Finnish woman called Pirjo Alexander. Pirjo. You know, I could never say her name properly. And I'm a bit obsessed with Finns. Anyway, I worked with her and we did cocktail parties for like 2,500 people and dinners for 700. And I was in the cold larder because girls couldn't be anywhere except the cold larder, of course. And I was lucky to get that job. I sort of had a kitchen hands job, but I was in the cold larder. And
you'd fear nothing about food if you catered for that many people.
Yeah,
at a cocktail party.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Wow. I knew so, and I learned so much. We used to do these unbelievably complicated canapés. Everyone had an element of color, texture. I mean, she taught me this, of color, texture, flavor. So, you know, there were these unbelievably complicated canapés. They look like something out of like a Escoffier cookbook that had all of these layers and textures, and they all got sprayed in aspic because it kept them, because there were two of us making these things. And then they got served on trays with big swan's necks made out of serviettes, made out of swan's necks and all that sort of thing. It was really like pretty amazing. It was an amazing cooking experience. And from that, I decided I wanted to cook. But I don't know that, I'll qualify that, I don't know that I was really a super talented cook. I don't think that when I, you know, I've met other people who just live and breathe. I, you know, I had a boyfriend who was a well-known cook and he just lived and breathed cookery. You know, he went to bed with cookbooks. He went, you know, there was nothing except cookbooks.
So how do you see yourself? Are you a host then, are you?
I think I'm a bit of an impresario, actually.
Right.
I think somebody once said that to me. Oh, you're like a bloody impresario.
Yeah.
And I had to look it up. I thought, what does an impresario do?
They put on shows.
Yeah, but I think it's sort of pulling things together. And I think that's, so I did catering. I did large scale catering. I did small scale catering, but I'd never really worked. I cooked in a very small restaurant in Hong Kong when I first went there, where it was another really hard place to get a job as a cook, be taken seriously as a female. You know, it's like people, no, women don't work in kitchens. It's like, well, they do all over the world, guys. But
So this is in Hong Kong. So what lured you to Hong Kong then?
I went to get a visa to go to China.
Right. So China was always the intention then?
Well, I was travelling, so China was like interesting. It was 1984 and it was like China was really an interesting, you know, weren't that many tourists going, but there were tourists going.
Mao had died
in 76.
And it was just starting to open up a tiny
It was just stunning because actually, you know, that policy that Deng Xiaoping put into place was in 1980.
Yes.
Yeah, it was 1978, but it came into sort of 1980, it really came into play.
So you arrive in Hong Kong to begin with?
Arrive in Hong Kong, hate Hong Kong.
Why?
So crowded. And so I'd been in Thailand, which was so lovely and so chilled out, and everybody was so chilled out. Hong Kong's so stressful and crowded and dirty and packed and all vertical and so expensive, and I hated it. I thought,
Hong Kong's a dump. Yeah, really?
I love Hong Kong.
Right, because Hong Kong is one of those completely addictive places, I think.
Well, I have been in other places where I have landed and 20 minutes after getting there, I've said I could live here. I said it in Mumbai. I didn't say it in London. Actually, I said it in Shanghai.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to think of other places.
But not Hong Kong.
I didn't say it in Hong Kong. And the funny thing is that Hong Kong is a place that's got lots of layers, I think.
Yeah.
And especially then, 1984, it was, you know, Margaret Thatcher had been there and handed over to the Chinese. But I worked in a restaurant called 97. I had no idea what it meant.
97
was the handover date. But really, nobody really knew much about it then. In 1984, it wasn't really common knowledge.
So you said it was hard for women to get a job as a chef in such places?
I was the second female in Hong Kong. The 97 group had employed a girl to start with. There was a woman. She was an English woman, I think. I didn't know her. And then they had an Austrian chef. And then I went in and eventually I talked these guys into giving me a job. But the chef resigned 4 days after I was there and said, get that woman out of my kitchen or I'm going.
And what did
and
you
so
say?
They
what
moved
did
you... me downstairs.
Yeah. You're pretty feisty, Michelle. Were you feisty then? Did you put
of
up with
course,
that?
Of course, yeah, of course. I was moved downstairs and they had another small restaurant. Sort of a long story, but there was a little restaurant, only had about 28 seats, and it was a cute little place with an open kitchen. It had a barbecue and one hot plate. That was it. And there was a guy down there, he was cooking, and there was a menu with steaks and hollandaise sauce and soup and escargot and all this sort of stuff that somebody had written this menu. There were photographs and recipes. The poor guy down there who was some guy from the kitchen upstairs, this was down the ground floor, sent down, doesn't speak a word of English. I go down. He's trying to read the Chinese overlay of instructions on the back of the hollandaise sauce packet because it's in a packet. It's Knorr hollandaise sauce. And I say, oh, for God's sake, there's only two people in there, two guys. It was lunchtime. I said, oh, Jesus, get out. Oh, for God's sake, poor guy. You know. Anyway, I didn't say poor guy. I'm sure I was like, oh, get out of the way, you idiot. And then I sort of came and I went over to these guys and I said, okay, give me 5 minutes, you know. And they were like, well, how long's our lunch going to be? And I said, you're beep lucky to get any goddamn thing, you know. I said, you just sit there and behave yourself. And one of the guys who was there is actually my oldest friend in Hong Kong. Right. We're still really good mates. Anyway, so I eventually managed to cook the steak and, you know, I chucked out the hollandaise sauce in the packet and, you know, put some pepper made of, I don't know, I can't remember what I did. And then they said, we want apple crumble. And there was a toaster oven, those little things that you open, mm-hmm. and there's a grill. And apple crumble was the evergreen, they called it. It was disgusting stuff. Anyway, I said it's upstairs. And they said, well, go and get it. And I said, you know, for God's sake, you don't get it. Anyway, I went up and got the apple crumble, put it in the thing. My friend Clive Rigby said, you burnt the top of it. I said, you want to wear this or you want to eat it? And he said, love a girl with attitude.
So your cooking career, you got off to a really flying start there.
But I was there for a year.
It's called the hospitality business, isn't it?
Yes. I was there for a year cooking and it was a wild job. So it was connected to the nightclub through a passage in the back.
Yeah, because I remember
there was a nightclub and...
I went there. I remember it. I went there in the 90s and in 91 and there were three...
Because our friend Greg was there.
Nation 97 and Post 97. I remember there were three places.
When I left, they turned it into... a Middle Eastern restaurant. And the funny thing was that actually the guy who I'd thrown me out of the kitchen, he ended up working there. But So
what was your philosophy of cooking, though, when you had
well,
to actually have
me,
set up a proper
actually,
kitchen
I
there?
Had sort of a bit of a... I actually ended up cooking there for a year, and we had 28 seats and the restaurant upstairs had 120 seats and we did more customers downstairs than upstairs.
Because you were serving proper food, right.
Well, we were sort of, I don't know how I did it, but, you know, we would, I'd cook, I'd be there at 9 in the morning, I'd make lunch, we'd do a full lunch service. I must have gone and slept for an hour, I suppose, but I didn't really have any helpers. And then I'd do dinner, and then I'd be on the dance floor with bottles of Dom Perignon at the end of the bar, and then some guy on the dance floor would say, can you make me some bratwurst sausages? So I'd say, yeah, give me half an hour. And then I'd sort of go back and I'd open up the kitchen at 2 o'clock in the morning and cook for everybody again. I mean, it's lunacy.
The kind of thing you can do when you're that young.
The kind of thing you can do when you're that age.
And in a city that was so awash with money as Hong Kong was in those days.
So much money flying around. I mean, I was totally underpaid. My first salary was $3,500 Hong Kong dollars and my rent was $1,800.
So then, 89, you set up your first proper restaurant, M on the Fringe.
M at the Fringe.
At the Fringe, I beg your pardon. M at the Fringe in Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong, next to the FCC.
And were you going to serve, what kind of food were you going to serve there? What was the plan?
Modern. We wanted to do modern food and sort of Mediterranean modern.
Western food, in other
words. Yeah, Western food, yes. Yeah, Western food. And very Western, not Asian-influenced food.
And how did you feel on the verge of opening night of this place?
Well, like I wanted to jump out the window.
Really?
Yes.
How bad was it?
It was, I just sat on the floor crying and thinking, oh, God, here are pink walls and stupid cutlery and nobody's going to like this place and oh, my God.
It wasn't ready?
Oh, I think it was pretty ready. I think it was as ready. But you're never ready, you know, you're never ready. It doesn't matter what you open, it's never ready.
Podcast. Broadcast and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
So you were there in Hong Kong with this restaurant you just set up, M at the Fringe, your first major restaurant, and you were in tears on opening night.
On the night before, sitting there crying on the floor, yeah.
Did it work anyway, though?
Yes, it was a big success. You know, it's sort of easy to look back on it now, and it was a lot of time in the making. It took 2 years from the time I started to work on it, and it was actually, I had a boyfriend at the time, and it was his idea to open a restaurant. Sadly for him, he had to go and have a heart transplant, and he wasn't there.
Why was it a success?
I think it was a success because it offered something new. It offered a different, you know, I felt that there were, you know, tons of restaurants in Hong Kong. I mean, Hong Kong is awash with restaurants. And in the late 90s, it was too, late 80s, sorry. But I think it was something new. It was informal, but it took food seriously. It took service seriously without having to, you know, click your fingers and every time you looked at a pack, everybody had cigarettes all over the table. You know, you'd look at the packet of cigarettes and some poor waiter would be there flashing a lighter at you. Or there were topless bars and, you know, pubs and you know, of course, tons of Chinese restaurants. You know, our favourites were wonton noodle shops, of course, but I think it offered something new in a new sort of way.
Stylish and informal and a bit glam.
It was stylish and informal and a bit glam. Yeah. It was beautifully designed by a Hong Kong guy. You know, and he said, it's got to reflect Hong Kong, but it's got to be European. Because I said, I don't want to serve a fusion of East and Western food. I want to serve... We had a rule, and our first chef was Sandra Dupuri, who is the winemaker at Yeringberg. And we had a rule that no one was allowed to put anything on the menu unless we'd eaten it in situ. So, you know, having been to Morocco, we were allowed to have this. Sandra had traveled a lot. She'd started doing medicine, ended up being a winemaker. Luckily, we had her first year of cooking, a professional. Well, it wasn't her first year, but so we had a sort of fairly eclectic menu, and it was very much from the Northern Atlantic to like Southern American cooking in some ways, and then Mediterranean and Turkish and Middle Eastern. And
you know, anyone who does public speaking, they have to kind of learn how to read a room, you know, before you make a speech. Mm. You have to sort of be able to know what the mood of the room is and what the room sort of really is. It a bit like that if you're opening a restaurant? You have to be able to read a city in a way or read a space around it.
I think you do. I think you also have to know a city. And I think one of the problems that I had in Beijing was that I didn't know Beijing as well as I think it's a very unknowable city in some ways. That doesn't justify that I didn't know it, but I didn't know it to the same extent that I knew Shanghai and Hong Kong.
What do you think about the whole thing of being, I mean, it was very successful, like you couldn't even get bookings in at your place.
Yeah,
what do you think about success and failure now that you've had some years to reflect on that?
I think that actually, you know, I think you need a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work to be successful. So you could be successful in the beginning, but I think it has to be sustained by a lot of hard work. It's not all luck. And then I think you can also have a bit of bad luck and you can still put in all the hard work and things can go entirely wrong. And whether, how do you deal with that? Actually, I think what makes or breaks, you know, you and a business. And, you know, having gone through SARS in Hong Kong, I mean, that was pretty tough experience. Having gone through various stages of different changes in China and, you know, instability in China. So I think there's a lot of things to contend with, but I think you learn much more from failure than you do from success.
So Shanghai.
On to Shanghai.
Your first visit to Shanghai, your first venture there.
I went in 1985, the first time.
Uh-huh. 85.
85, and I loved it. I was like, oh, wow.
And Shanghai.
Oh, I love this place.
Yeah, but what could you see the promise in it? Like,
No, I think in 1985, the promise was, oh my God, it's like set in aspic. And, you know, and everything was being pulled down in Hong Kong at a rate of knots. You know, everything was coming down in Hong Kong. And I was obsessed with old, you know, I loved old buildings and old, had to be old. And I had a lot of really strong ideas in Hong Kong. It had to be independent. I didn't want to be, I used to say, oh, for God's sake, you know, go into an office tower and press an office lift and go to the 17th floor and have some poor Chinese kids sing, you know, volare to you. You're in an Italian restaurant. I mean, what sort of rubbish is this with Czech tablecloths and everybody's Chinese and it tastes like noodles, you know? It tastes exactly like Chinese noodles, not like spaghetti. So
you're looking for authentic then?
I had this sort of thing of being authentic.
So when you went back again in 95?
I went back a lot of times. Yeah. So I knew Shanghai well.
Okay. Yeah. And what was your first restaurant venture there?
Well, in 95, I went back with Bruno, actually, who worked with me for many, many years. And he said, why don't we open a restaurant? So he was running, he was a maitre d' of the restaurant in Hong Kong. And I said, oh God, you're out of your mind. And he said, no, come on, you know, let's really have a, and I said, oh, it's not maybe, you know, I said, it's a few years away, but yeah, sure, let's start thinking about it. And then the following year, I was with a friend who was organizing a party at the Peace Hotel. And so I was there with him and sort of, you know, co-organizing with him. And I talked to the manager, the general manager, and I said, can I come and bring my restaurant from Hong Kong to your hotel for, you know, for a week? And he said, well, I don't know. Can you cook? And I thought, well, that's not really the point because I'm not the cook anyway. But anyway, I said, yeah, of course I can cook. And so
This
is the Peace Hotel.
This is on Shanghai's Bund.
Yeah,
this
on
is
the Bund,
a
yeah.
classic old hotel.
Yeah, yeah. Built in 1920.
Something or other.
I think it's 26
built
or
between the wars. And this is where Noel Coward wrote Private Lines. Charlie
it's
Chaplin
super
stayed
famous.
There.
Super famous,
right.
Yeah.
And it's sort of fallen into the doldrums in the communist era.
I mean, it was still sort of grand in its own way. I mean, it's amazing. It had 940 rooms or something and like 2,000 staff. Anyway, it was totally like state-owned enterprise, you know, like full commie experience.
And how did you smuggle Western food into your first venture there?
Well, actually, I had to cook, so somebody carried an entire meal in hand luggage to me to deliver at my door, and I went down to the kitchen in hand luggage. There was salmon, soup, mashed potatoes, some sort of green beans or asparagus or something, a pavlova base, the cream, the fruit, and the cream was whipped, the fruit for the pavlova, and I served a three-course meal with six guys in a kitchen, none of them, I didn't speak a word of Mandarin. They didn't speak a word of English. Somehow we managed all of this. I guess somebody translated for us. And at the end of that dinner, Mr. Wang, who was 6'2" and recited Chinese poetry all the time, said, okay, you can come for a month and you can come next week. And I said, no, Mr. Wang, it's not going to work like that. I said, I will come in 3 months and I'll come for a week. And so we have, you know, we worked it out, and we did go. Five of us went. At that point, Andrew McConnell was our chef in Hong Kong. So Andrew and his partner came, and a friend who actually waited on the floor who ended up working with us, and one of our Cantonese cooks. We thought, we have to take somebody who speaks Chinese. He didn't speak a word of Mandarin. He only spoke Cantonese. Yeah. You know, so we talk about stupid.
How did you get them to clean the windows in the Peace Hotel?
They didn't clean the windows. I did. I pulled the curtains off as we were about to open. I pulled them off because I kept saying, please, can you take these curtains? Please, can we put up the, please, can you clean the windows? And they were like, oh, no, you have to get the man with the key, and you have to get the man. The curtain man has to come in, or the window man has somebody, you know.
There's a curtain man and a window man with the key?
There's always a man with a key in China. For everything. I mean, we didn't have any cutlery. We got there and there were no knives. So actually we had to get somebody to fly up with the knives. And imagine, oh no, we've only got 100 sort of, you know, steak knives in hand luggage. And so I pulled right before we opened. I spent the day cleaning. I took flowers. I mean, I took flowers to China. I took a box. It was near Christmas, December. I took a box of,
Brought them anyway.
We took 550 kilos of luggage between us. We had salmon, wine, champagne, flowers, vegetables, and we had everything you could think of. And right before we were about to open, which was supposed to be 6 o'clock, but the Peace Hotel, the Jinjiang Group guys turned up at 5 o'clock and said, we're ready. And they were like, you have to be ready because our bosses are here. I was like, I told you I'm not ready. Anyway, I'd pulled the curtains off the window, just yanked them off and said, these please go to the cleaners. And I cleaned the window and everyone went, oh my God, look at that view.
And like, that was
yes,
the view.
Hello.
Right.
And that, there's a view out there.
Right. And that view was of the river and of Pudong across the river.
The view was of the river. Well, right. Pudong
wasn't even there, I suppose.
The Pearl Oriental TV Tower was there, which was the only thing that mattered. Yeah.
So there was this kind of amazing view out of the windows.
There was this incredible, well, it was of the river. It was the view of the Bund and the river. And it's a fantastic river because it's a working river. It's a remarkable river.
Then you found the space for your restaurant, which is still there today.
That took 2 years.
2 years.
I had a lot of mishaps. And then 2 years later, I ended up opening back on the Bund in Shanghai.
What did the space look like when you found it?
It was like a shed, really. It was built on top of a building. And it had been added sometime, I guess, in the late 70s or early 80s, which was what happened a lot in China when China didn't have the money to build. People sort of don't remember this, didn't have the money to build. They just built on top of buildings. My apartment building had 3 stories added to it too. It was a lean-to, really. And the whole floor, because it was the roof, the floor was 1.3 meters lower on one side than on the other because the whole thing slanted for drainage. So actually the clever architects, Roger Hackworth and Deborah Little, brilliant people, they actually put all the services under the floor. And it wasn't very high ceiling, but the rest of the building was beautiful, original, untouched, beautiful. It still belongs to the Shanghai Shipping Company. It did then, and it still does now.
The fact that you were on a roof, that meant you had a terrace though, didn't
we it? We have this beautiful terrace. It's just fantastic. It's a beautiful, beautiful terrace. And you've been there, Richard, but anyone who's been there will know it, you know, that it just, you walk out. When I came, there was a wall where that terrace, you know, that wasn't all there. Contrary to popular opinion, people often say to me, I don't know why people think you're so smart. This is a no-brainer. It's like, well, it wasn't. When we took it, it wasn't a no-brainer, believe me.
It was a lean-to. Rupert Murdoch couldn't make it work in China. How did you get it to work? How did you make that happen? I mean, admittedly, his plans were a tiny bit more ambitious, but nonetheless, what's the key for someone trying to do business in China?
I think you have to be fairly determined with what you want to do, and I think you have to really work hard, and I think you have to have some empathy for the poor people that you deal with, who, you know, are the low guys you deal with. They can't do anything. You have to understand that many of them, they're doing their best for you. I had so many people help, really, I did. And, you know, I hear this, it drives me crazy when I hear people say, you can't dress a Chinese. I think, you know, that it's just so unfair. I had so many people who were so kind, and you just got to be determined and keep going. And actually, I think in all business, there's ups and there's downs. And the great thing about, you know, owning your own business or having a few shareholders and, you know, not too many people you have to sort of, you know, explain too much to, is that you can decide it doesn't matter if we don't make a profit this year. It doesn't matter. It's not the end of the world. You know, we've had good years and other years are not so great, but it's okay. You know, it's a business. It's about longevity. So I think actually this approach that we have in the sort of capitalist world, in the Western world, actually all over the world, that you have to be making this, you have to be posting. I feel so sorry for those people in big companies who have to post quarterly profits and profit warnings. And I just think, my God, what a lot of pressure. Because I think it's unrealistic for things to just constantly be constantly making money. There are times when things are tough and things, you have to get through them. And you just have to be determined to get through them.
You opened another restaurant in Beijing, the Capital
M. I did, yeah.
Right on the edge of Tiananmen Square.
And on the south side of Tiananmen, looking at the square.
Looking exactly. at the Tiananmen Gate, in
looking
fact.
Looking at the gates, and, yeah. And well, looking at, actually looking at the Arrow Gate, looking at the Zhongnanmen Gate.
Yeah. Yeah. And you said that didn't in the end pan out, that you've had to close that.
It didn't pan out. And actually, you know, partly I think that was not knowing the city and and just sort of feeling that actually we're on Tiananmen Square. I mean, it's the middle. There has been a city here for like, you know, 1,200 years. How can it go wrong? But of course, it was not the people don't live there, and the people who do live there aren't the customers. And Beijing's a very difficult city to get around. Traffic is legendarily difficult, and it is a was a beautiful place, but very hard to get to, and it was too big. And it was sort of the wrong place at the wrong time.
Beijing has amazingly good Chinese food in a way
Beijing
that Shanghai
does,
probably didn't.
Exactly.
Those days.
That's very true. And I think also that Beijing is just Beijing is a much more Chinese city. That
it
sounds
is.
Ridiculous.
No,
I
but
know,
it definitely
but
is, yes.
It is. And so I think that the concept of Western food just isn't. Yeah, Shanghai is a much more cosmopolitan sort of international city. And people in Shanghai, even if they've never stepped across the river, basically sort of say, yes, we know French because we have a French, former French concession. Former, I always say, it's a yes. former French concession. Not the French concession, it's a former French concession.
You know, Robert Hughes had a theory about this. Robert Hughes, the late Robert Hughes, the yes. Australian yeah. art critic, he used to say bureaucrats don't like port cities. This is why the capital of Australia is Canberra and not Sydney. This is why the capital
maybe.
Of the United States is Washington and not New York.
Maybe.
Capital of China is Beijing and not Shanghai. Bureaucrats kind of like an inland city. Ottawa,
well, probably
rather
like a
than...
city that they can control,
yes,
where
that's
it's
right.
all about them.
Or
and that's Beijing. It's a political city. And I would just really like to put on the record officially, nobody in Beijing went out of their way, apart from maybe our landlords who didn't go anywhere in their way to help, but actually nobody went out of their way to make things difficult. Actually, we had like vice mayors trying to help us, trying to figure out how we could stay there. But it's a bigger, it's, you're in the middle of security apparatus land, and it's just like, there's no way, you know. And they all would say, you're lucky that they let you be here. And I'd think, you're lucky I'm here.
Well, wouldn't they be having military parades going past the front of that, around there all the time?
And then they close this day. I mean, and so on the, of course, you know, I mean, this was not about us. And to rehearsals for military parades, they'd close the entire area down by 12 o'clock on Saturday, and you opened again at 4 o'clock on Sunday. That was when nobody was allowed in the whole area. So for us, that was Saturday lunch, Saturday night, and Sunday brunch, which, you know, in Beijing were our busiest times.
Given that you're running a restaurant and you like everything to work properly, and
yes,
I'm
obsessive compulsive, yes.
When you're dealing with, like, I don't know, waiters, for example, and they're not pulling their weight, is it kind of awkward culturally for you to then confront a waiter who's not up to speed and sack that waiter
I'm luckily for me, I have got really fantastic people and I don't have to be involved to that extent anymore. But I do know all of the staff. And one of the things, at one point we had like nearly 300 staff, which I hated having that many. I didn't know them. I didn't know, of course I knew all the key people, but I didn't know even waiters. I didn't know people's names. And the last 3 months or the last year of Beijing, I spent most of my time there and I actually got to know all of the staff. And, you know, they were fantastic. You know, they just, people really banded together to make it work. It's, you know, it's difficult. We have one waiter in Shanghai who is much ruder to local people, to Chinese people than he is. And that's so hard for me because, you know, we have to say to him, you can't do this. You know, you just mustn't. It's crazy. So I have to say to the management staff, you have to keep an eye. He's a fantastic waiter. I say, you have to keep an eye on him and you have to stop it. And you have to step in if you see it happening. Because the bulk of our clientele is local. You know, we have a lot of international visitors, but we're in China. We have a big restaurant and we serve hundreds of people every day, and most of them are Chinese.
China's a big, exciting place at the moment. Australia and Australians are particularly front of mind for the Chinese at the moment. But when they do, when they speak about China, when you talk to Chinese people or get some sort of sense of how Australia is seen, if it's seen at all, what impressions do you get, Michelle?
I think that actually that's been a pretty rocky relationship recently, and that isn't a good thing. And I think there's been, you know, the People's Daily and thing can, you know, they can wind things up, let's say, and, you know, make some blame. And you see what happens in China when the Chinese government don't like things. You know, suddenly there's no Danish butter or there's no French cream or there's no, you know, so I've seen things, mostly it passes pretty quickly.
So that's something that a minister or it might be reported in the People's
Daily.
Who
knows,
but then how does that then filter down to...
Not really. I mean, I always sort of, like, I walk through the streets of Sydney or Melbourne, and I smile at everybody who's Chinese, and I probably think, who's this lunatic white woman smiling at us? But, you know, I sort of think, well, you're my people, you know, but... And I talked, most people say, yeah, it's not, you know, but life is pretty good and, you know, in Australia. But I think there's been a bit of negative stuff in China and that's not good. But it has absolutely paled in comparison to the bullying coming out of the US against China at the moment, paled in comparison. But I think, you know, the Communist Party's a big, powerful party. They don't like things that don't work their way, but, you know.
If you could talk to that girl who came barreling out of Elwood High School all those years ago, and if you could say, or someone could have told you then, you know, that you'd go on to run a very successful restaurant in Hong Kong and an even more successful one in Shanghai, do you have any idea of what you would have thought back then?
I have no idea. I remember on my 30th birthday crying into whatever I was initially crying into the bolognese sauce or whatever it was, and thinking I'm never going to succeed at anything. You know, I dropped out of Monash University.
Really?
I didn't even finish my diploma of catering. Nobody at William Angelus knows that, and even the Dean of Arts said to me, oh, don't worry about it, doesn't matter, we're still proud of you. I'm like, and I thought, I'm just never going to finish, and nothing's going to work, really. I just thought, what am I doing? And when I left Australia again, I was 27 or something like that, and I remember everybody saying to me, I worked at Turak Catering, and I remember everybody saying to me, you've got to come on, pull yourself together. You know, that's enough of running around the world, you know, having fun. Pull yourself together. You've, you know, it's stupid. You've just got to settle down. And I was like, I'm out of here. I'm not settling down in this joint.
Good advice. How great to speak with you, Michelle.
Failed catering student.
Who's done rather well nonetheless. It's been such a pleasure, Michelle. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Richard. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.